However, it has a legacy of centuries that we will be unleashing sea level rise because heat trapping gases, 15 to 45% of carbon dioxide we release in the atmosphere today will be trapping heat day in, day out over 1,000 years. So that
Rob Nixon,
idea
let me ask you on the issue
important.
Of hope.
Yeah, well, I would come back to the technological changes and the generational changes. I think the priorities in terms of mitigation, adaptation, resilience that we see from
5 seconds.
Younger people today give us hope, but there has to be a massive surge of concerted action.
Rob Nixon, author of Slow Violence and the Environmentalists and the Poor, Brenda Eckersall of the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Nathaniel Rich will link to your piece in the New York Times, Losing Earth, the Decade We Almost Stopped Climate Change. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Sojourner Truth. Sojourner Truth Radio, looking at the backlash to Trump's trade war.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands, on Monday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza in Portland. Facing America's Nuclear Legacy will remember the victims of the August 6th and August 9th, 1945 atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Speakers will discuss the lasting impacts of decades of nuclear weapons testing, the nuclear weapons situation between the United States and North Korea, the toxic cycle of nuclear weapons production, and more. Again, that's Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands, on Monday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm. on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Slip a bookmark into your paperback and listen to KBOO for interviews with your favorite fiction and nonfiction writers. Between the Covers airs Thursdays from 11 to 11:30 a.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, Trump's trade war. Can the U.S. stop what seems to be the inevitable? A multipolar economic world in which the U.S. is not the only game in town. The backlash against Trump's tariffs. What is the GOP and industry afraid of? What does all of this mean for you and I? Economist Mark Weisbrot breaks it down. Also, a key presidential election in Zimbabwe for the first time in nearly 40 years. Mugabe is not on the ticket. Assumpta Oturu, host of KPFK's Spotlight Africa, joins us. And Afro-Cuban musician Deramir Gonzalez, who is on tour in the United States, will join us. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. A federal judge in Seattle has issued a temporary restraining order to stop today's scheduled online publication of blueprints to make untraceable and undetectable 3D printed plastic guns. Eight Democratic attorneys general filed a lawsuit Monday seeking to block the federal government's settlement with the company to make the plans available online. Washington's Attorney General Bob Ferguson welcomed the judge's action.
That means that for any entity or individual to post that information online is illegal under federal law, just as it was before the federal government made the unfortunate decision to allow it. So we go back to the status quo before the federal government made this decision.
Congressional Democrats have urged President Trump to reverse his administration's decision to let the company Defense Distributed publish the plans online. Trump tweeted he's looking into the idea, saying making 3D plastic guns available to the public doesn't seem to make much sense. Top federal immigration officials defended their handling of the Trump administration's family separation policy, which was discarded after searing public criticism. At a Senate Judiciary Committee meeting, the Executive Associate Director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Matthew Albence, compared the immigrant children's detention to summer camp.
I think the best way to describe them is to be more like a summer camp. These individuals have access to 24/7 food and water. They have educational opportunities. They have recreational opportunities, both structured as well as unstructured.
Illinois Democratic Senator Richard Durbin called on Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen to resign, saying it was under her watch that families were separated.
711 lost children and common decency. I am today calling on the architect of this humanitarian disaster, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, to step down. The family separation policy is more than a bureaucratic lapse in judgment. It is and was a cruel policy inconsistent with the bedrock values of this nation. Someone in this administration has to accept responsibility.
As hundreds more firefighters joined the battle against two major blazes burning in Northern California's Mendocino and Lake counties, a new fire broke out in Mendocino. Firefighters continue to battle the state's largest blaze near the Northern California city of Redding. Altogether, 17 major blazes are burning in the state. CAL FIRE Public Information Officer Heather Williams said wildfire activity in California is more extreme this year compared to last and shows no sign of slowing down.
We're definitely seeing extreme wildfire behavior, and it is only July. We are definitely surpassed where we were last year at this time in terms of wildfire activity. And last week alone, we responded to over 800 wildfires in CAL FIRE jurisdiction. So on top of battling these large wildfires, we were also doing initial attack on over 100 fires a day.
Climate scientists say the state's worsening wildfires are due to global warming. Large areas of China could be uninhabitable by the end of the century due to heat waves. The study by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology said global warming will make farming in the fertile North China Plain impossible and leave the region uninhabitable due to the heat. The plain is the most populous region of China and is a major food-producing region. The research said the combination of rising heat and humidity in the area will mean that a healthy person would not be able to survive outdoors for more than 6 hours. Hundreds of angry opposition supporters gathered outside Zimbabwe's Electoral Commission, insisting that the parliamentary and presidential vote was stolen. Police fired tear gas and stun grenades. Zimbabwe's Electoral Commission announced parliamentary results showing that the ruling ZANU-PF party had won 110 parliamentary seats to 41 for the main opposition MDC alliance. The commission has not released any results in the presidential race, which is the first after the fall of Robert Mugabe. The Electoral Commission said it would say sometime tomorrow when it will start announcing the results of the race, pitting President Emmerson Mnangagwa against opposition leader Nelson Chamisa. The European Union Election Observer Mission expressed serious concerns about the delay in reporting the presidential vote. It also said a truly level playing field was not achieved in the election, pointing out misuse of state resources, instances of coercion and intimidation, partisan behavior by traditional leaders, and overt bias in the state media. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to start off today with focusing on some international news, a big election happening in Zimbabwe yesterday, Monday, July 30th. Millions of people across the East African nation of Zimbabwe packed the polls to elect a new president and 303 members of both houses of parliament. It is reported that lines began at voter polls, including in rural areas, as early as 5 in the morning. It is the first election that Mugabe, for 40 years, close to 40 years, who was the ruler of South Africa, he is not on the polls. Now, Emmerson Mnangagwa, representing the Zimbabwe National Front, or ZANU-PF, faced off against Nelson Chamisa of the Movement for Democratic Change. The elections were the first held without the former prime minister and President Robert Mugabe on the ballot since 1980. That was the year that Zimbabwe won independence from the UK. Now, hours before the election, Robert Mugabe declared that the elections will not be free, and basically saying that he will vote for the opposition, that he will not support the ZANU-PF candidate. He indicated that Chamisa was the only viable candidate. He said, "I cannot vote for those who have tormented me." Mugabe was forced out of office November of 2017, following a series of protests and internal struggles, and internal struggles also within his own party, ZANU-PF. And indeed, he was forced out by the Mnangagwa faction of the party. Now, Mnangagwa is the first vice president of Zimbabwe under Mugabe, and he replaced the longtime leader after he was forced out. Now, his presidency and ZANU's incumbency is being challenged by Chamisa. Controversy has been around the Robert Mugabe's government for decades now, but specifically, Mnangagwa has been blamed for the Zimbabwe army's brutal killings during the 1980s in Matabeleland, which left 10 to 20,000 civilians dead. The victims were the Ndebele people, a tribal minority in Zimbabwe who represent about 15% of the country's total voting population. The Shona tribe is Zimbabwe's largest indigenous groups. Now, human rights groups claim that Mnangagwa ordered, who was involved with the army at the time, ordered the killings, but it was under Mugabe's demands. Well, we'll see. There's been a lot of controversy and very strong views on both sides of the legacy of Mugabe, who came into power opposing colonialism and then who started a land redistribution program that was opposed clearly by the farmers, particularly the white farmers who owned so much of the land. But since then, there are reports of corruption being rife in his administration. We also know that corruption is one way that Western powers use to destabilize and undermine governments that they are not supportive of. What we're going to do now is, before we welcome our guests, we're going to go to a few clips, one from BBC, another from France 24, and Express UK, that gives you a sense of what is happening on the ground in Zimbabwe.
Just before 7 o'clock and we are about an hour's drive outside of Harare in a place called Dombashaba. And we've got people that are waiting here to cast their votes. The polling station is about to open shortly.
I was here already up past 4 and it's very important for me to get up that early because I want to cast my vote so that I'll be happy after election.
I come here to vote for my children so that they have to get jobs. This is what we want here in Zimbabwe.
Well, this is the first election where President Robert Mugabe is not going to be seen on the ballot papers. Now, that is the first time in 38 years. And a number of the people here are excited about that because it means that they get a chance to consider another option.
Everyone is, have got the freedom to choose or to vote for what he wants. And there are so many people who have died for the last elections. So we think this year we are going to have peace in this country.
Since 1980, there was no freedom of speech. So I want to express that through my vote.
I would like everybody to be employed. I would like some clinics to have medicine. I would like people to go to schools, more clinics, more jobs for everyone.
The voting has started. It's moving quickly. So the latest that we're hearing the results will come out is Saturday, but there's a chance that they could be out earlier.
On Monday, voters will choose between 23 different candidates, with incumbent Emmerson Mnangagwa and opposition candidate Nelson Chamisa leading in the polls. Though Mnangagwa, a former Mugabe ally, is running on the ruling ZANU-PF party's ticket, Mugabe said in a surprise announcement on the eve of the election that he would vote for Nelson Chamisa.
I cannot vote for those who have tormented me. No, I can't.
With the support of the army, Mnangagwa ousted Robert Mugabe from power last November after 37 years of rule. Mnangagwa reacted quickly to the former president's endorsement of Chamisa, suggesting a vote for the opposition candidate is a vote for Mugabe.
Now that it is clear to all that Chamisa has forged a deal with Mugabe, we can no longer believe that his intentions are to transform Zimbabwe and rebuild our nation.
Despite accusations of involvement in election violence and fraud, Mnangagwa has promised the election will be free and fair and has invited international observers to monitor the process. For his part, opposition leader Nelson Chamisa welcomed Mugabe's endorsement, though he has promised to bring change to the country.
This is a crucial election. This is a do or die. It's not about the past. It's about the future. It's not about Mr. Mugabe. It's not on the ballot. It's about this candidate appealing to all the citizens to have a vote.
If none of the candidates win at least 50% of the vote in the first round, a presidential runoff has been scheduled for September.
Well, it's a great moment for Zimbabwe, hoping that in the rural areas, the ballot that has been used is an appropriate one. But we have no doubt that if the ballot is an appropriate one, a genuine one, and not a bastardized or a fake one, victory is certain for the people. The people have spoken, the people are speaking, and it's clear that the vote is a vote for victory, a vote for freedom, a vote for democracy, a vote for a new Zimbabwe, a vote for the genuine new, a vote for a new direction. And I have no doubt that by end of day today, we should be very clear as to an emphatic voice for change, an emphatic voice for the new, an emphatic voice for the young. And I represent that young, I represent that new.
All righty, and that last clip, you heard the voice of Nelson Chamisa, and the headline of the Express of the UK is saying that he is winning resoundingly, but of course there are no election results. We likely won't have any for the at least the next 4 days or so. Now, 60% of the 5.6 million registered voters in Zimbabwe are under 40. So Chamisa's appeal there to the youth make up more than 75% of the population of almost 17 million in Zimbabwe. So their voices are going to be very important in all of this. I would now like to welcome Assumpta Oturu, independent radio host and producer of Spotlight Africa, a weekly show that focuses on Africa's current affairs, politics, economic, social, and women's issues. Spotlight Africa airs on Pacifica Radio's KPFK on Saturdays from noon to 1 p.m. Assumpta, welcome back.
Thank you very much, my sister. How are you doing this morning?
Okay. Now, Assumpta, a big election here in Zimbabwe, and Robert Mugabe pulled a surprise move just hours before the polls opened, basically saying that he is not going to support the candidate of the party, ZANU party, that he has been a part of, but also the party that ousted him. Your thoughts on this move of Mugabe, and if you think it'll have any impact on the results, Assumpta?
I think Mugabe is realizing too late, because this is something that he should have done while he was in power, to groom somebody young to get into the presidency. But now that he's been ousted, I think he's making a choice too late. And of course, it's understandable that he's not happy with those who ousted him. But the question is, will Emmerson Mnangagwa actually agree for the party that has ruled Zimbabwe for so long to commit political suicide? I doubt it that very much. But I'm not surprised by Mugabe's endorsement of Nelson Chamisa, because he's realizing that there is that feud between the old and the young. So now it's time to pass the baton to the young. And I think ZANU-PF has a challenge too, to sort of reconcile between the youth that challenged the party. So there is that internal conflict. And if it so happens that Chamisa wins, then it will be the victory for the youth. But if it so happens that Mnangagwa manages to remain in power, because we know that when he came into power in November last year, he did not say that he was coming in as a caretaker government. So in this election, he's actually looking for endorsement to ensure that he has some reign in power for some time. And if that is the case, then it's very important that he begins to groom the youth, because I don't think the youth are going to be satisfied with the on hold of power by the old generation. And I think that is what is critical. And it's not surprising that Mugabe endorsed Nelson Chamisa.
Yeah, now at the time that basically internal coup happened last November against Robert Mugabe, I spoke with someone from Africans Rising, which is a growing movement across the continent, and specifically with Kimu Nedu, who was raised basically in South Africa, and he said he was raised singing the praises and songs of Mugabe, given the independence fight that included guerrilla warfare to really bring down the British colonial rule there. But he also then talked about the disappointment that set in, given some of the reports of atrocities and corruption in the Mugabe government. And as you say, not grooming someone, but Mugabe seemed bent on holding on to power, even though he was like around 93 years old. But there's still a lot of heart and feeling and support for Mugabe, particularly in the diaspora, simply because of his anti-colonial position. But as I said in the intro, we also know that the powers that be, the Western powers, they, particularly in the global South, they really use corruption as a way to discredit and undermine governments who don't, that they don't agree with. And unfortunately, some in those governments, including some heads of state, fall for the corruption and themselves get involved in it. Your comment, Aturo, about all of this context?
Well, corruption, as I was speaking to a friend yesterday, is that is another new weapon that the West is using against prospective developments on the continent. Because soon after independence, we had the experience of coups. Soon after the coups became illegitimate, then, of course, democratic waves swept the continent. But then how else do you prevent development? You encourage corruption. And corruption is taking money out of the national treasury for the purposes of development, and you just enrich yourself. And Kenya is working on trying to solve that problem. But aside from Kenya, that's another topic. But in terms of Zimbabwe, what people tend to omit when they discuss the corruption and so forth is the very fact that, because we had the similar experience in other countries in Africa, whereby challenging the West, which Mugabe did by the ownership of land and redistributing land, that was the beginning of the imposition of sanctions and the challenge of Mugabe. Suddenly, Robert Mugabe, whom the West liked, became this dictator and so on, and therefore the economy in Zimbabwe collapsed because of the fact of the Western sanctions against Zimbabwe. And they knew very well this would work in favor of their support of the movement for democratic change, which now was appealing to the youth who were unemployed. And that is the majority of the population throughout, even in Zimbabwe or other parts of Africa. So if you do that, then you are sort of bringing a rift between the older people in Zimbabwe, who in actual fact remember the war and support Mugabe because of what he did, which his party did, and the majority of Zimbabwe, including some of those officials, military officials who ousted him. These were all his commanders. They worked together during the Liberation War. But the thing is this, that now Zimbabwe has to resolve the issue of the elder and the youth. It's time to transition power. So this is a test that Mnangagwa, who himself is in his 70s, has to reconsider. Because if he wins this victory, then he has to seriously look at what the replacement of the leadership in the ruling party, because the feud is within the ruling party is between the young and the old. The feud in the country is also between the young and the old. The feud between the country within the country is also the issue of marginalization. You mentioned Matabeleland, who Mnangagwa is accused of having enabled the genocide against the Matabele people. So that's another question that is hanging around his neck. So he has to resolve all these issues to move forward. But I doubt very much that ZANU-PF will agree to commit political suicide in this case. And I think we only witnessed that in Zambia, when the ruling party of the president, Kenneth Kaunda, was defeated. But I doubt it will happen in Zimbabwe, because I don't think Mnangagwa came in as a caretaker government. He's also there to use this election to entrench himself in power.
Yeah, and Assumpta Arturo, our guest here, host of Spotlight Africa and KPFK's Spotlight Africa, there were a lot of concerns about the role of the military and whether, intimidation of voters, and also whether the military, if indeed Chamisa comes out ahead, as you say, Mnangagwa isn't easily going to give up power. But we also know that elections, there are so fraught. I mean, even elections in the United States right now are being put under question, much less elections that happen in the global south, where there are so much opportunity for fraud, as we have seen in Haiti, we have seen in Honduras. Some people said we saw in Kenya, and in other places. So who knows what actually the real story will be, whoever the winner is. But it does seem as though Chamisa, who is sounding very, very optimistic, is really depending on the youth vote coming out. Because if young people do come out and vote, it seems as though he really stands a very good chance, Assumpta.
Yeah, he does. But the question is, will the party permit that? And I think that's the big question. And don't forget, too, that ZANU-PF enjoys the majority of support in the rural areas. Mm-hmm. And most of the movement for democratic movement have got support of the youth in the urban centers. So as Managangwa used the slogan, a vote for Chimeza, Chamisa is a vote for Mugabe. So that alone is something that can, let people think and say, really, is that what it is? But if you are not sophisticated enough to think about it, then of course it's automatic that, no, I'm not going to vote for him. I better not vote for Mugabe. I better vote for this man who said he was going to bring change. So it really depends on the education of the voter, how they will act. But I know that the youth will probably still support the movement for democratic change. But the question is, if they come into power, given the history that there's been a lot of Western involvement in the movement for democratic change and grooming and, Morgan Tsvangirai.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that question whether they will actually reverse some of the policies in terms of land and so on.
Yeah.
So that is another issue, because if they are externally supported, as has always been claimed, will that happen? So those are some of the inner issue, and I don't think the military will accept that, because they know who this party is. And I don't think they will allow that to happen. I think what will happen is that Mnangagwa will still be in power. Mnangagwa, I may have to eat my words come Saturday, but anyway.
Yeah, no, but
I think they will.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, but Assumpta, you make a very good point. You're really doing a great job breaking all of this down for us, I'll have to say. And that's why we love to encourage you, Assumpta, to come on to the show. The other context of all of this, in the global context, as you say, in Zimbabwe, a very young population. Across the continent of Africa, a very young population. In the United States and in Europe, you see a very old population. And there are all these articles now about how younger women in the United States, but this is also happening in Europe, are refusing to have babies. They're just not having babies, and when you look at the lack of support for mothers in particular, one could really see why. But there is a lot of concern about, I think really keeping Africa down, because it's one of the most impoverished continent in the world, but it's also the wealthiest continent in the world in terms of the mineral resources, the resources, cobalt that's needed for cell phones, that's needed for weapons, that's needed even for television sets. All of that stuff comes out of Africa, right? So it does seem as though a lot of the manipulation and sides, because you could really see the Western factions, pressing forward to what they hope to be a winner in terms of Chamisa, but perhaps for different reasons that the young people are voting for Chamisa. Do you know what I mean? So all of this is really part of the whole continuation of the struggle for freedom in Africa. Just a final thought from you, Assumpta.
Well, my thinking is that there is a lot of promise, despite all this, that rising young presidents are coming up, because I think even the president of Senegal, Mr. Sall, is a young person. And if you think of Gambia, it's the same. And if you think of this other country, Ethiopia, for example, a lot of Ethiopians came out on Sunday to meet their Prime Minister. There was a lot of hope and cheer about, sorry about the noise in the background, for this new leader who has got a greater vision for change in Ethiopia. So
yeah, including making peace with Eritrea, right?
Yeah. So, on. So he's been able to do a lot of things within the first 100 years of his being in power. So the promise of the youth is there, and I think I have to move. And I think that
That's quite all right, Assumpta. I know that you are rushing out to try to get out to work here. I hear you saying you have to move. So maybe we should just wrap it up.
No, I was just moving away from the noise over there.
Okay.
So the thing is, though, that the acknowledgement of the youth as leaders is very important, because we also in South Africa, we know of what is his name? Julius Malema. He's challenging the system. So they are there. They are there waking up and so forth. So the mere fact that Nelson Chamisa is on this ballot brings the issue to the ruling party in Zimbabwe to seriously consider the youth.
Right, so and the future moving forward. Assumpta, we are out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there. So we have to really look and see if this youth means going in the right direction, or it just means, you know, more of the same, right? It depends on what you stand for rather than your age or even your sex, and for that matter. But I think you're right. We really have to look with some hope at this emerging leadership in several countries across the continent. Assumpta Aturo, thank you so very much for joining us.
You're welcome anytime. Thank you.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a short station break. And coming up, economist Mark Weisbrot joins us on this whole trade war tariff saga drama that's going on. And also, Dirimer Gonzalez, Afro-Cuban pianist and composer, will be our guest. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Good morning. It's 8:36. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up at 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know on KBOO.
And you heard us play our morning song, Lubu, sung in Dida by Dobe Nahor. And we are remembering Ron Dellums, who has died, the former black congressman Ron Dellums, who died at age 82. And speaking of freeing Africa, Ron Dellums played a key role in the anti-apartheid movement. He also opposed wars in the U.S., military spending. He was one of the founders of the Congressional Black Caucus. He identified himself as a democratic socialist and as an anti-war activist and a social justice activist. He became the first black congressman in Northern California. He died Monday. He was 82 years old. Today, we remember Congressman Ron Dellums. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you miss any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety, and you can subscribe to a free podcast. And you can also check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. We're also on SoundCloud, and just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. Today, we'd like to give a SoundCloud to our listeners in Seattle, Washington, in the United States, and in Zimbabwe on the continent of Africa. We're now going to turn our attention to what some refer to as trade wars. Some say it is merely a trade skirmish, but Donald Trump continues to move the U.S. in trade and foreign policy in an isolationist direction as part of his America First and Make America Great Again. He's gotten the country embroiled in what is commonly referred to as a trade war. Now, he began earlier this year with tariffs on washing machines, much of the benefit of U.S. Benton Harbor-based multinational corporation Whirlpool. His tariff targets now include the European Union, Canada, Mexico, China, and South Korea. But it does seem that China, the world's second largest economy, is the primary target. Key products affected by Trump's tariffs include steel, aluminum, soybeans, cars, bourbon, whiskey, motorboats, yachts, motorcycles, blue jeans, and more. Even pigs, I think, are all part of it. It is notable that the imposition of tariffs is the one area that congressional Republicans have broken with Trump on. GOP members of Congress are skittish, given that the following states will be most negatively impacted by Trump's plan: Texas, Alabama, South Carolina, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, all states that were decisive in Trump's 2016 election. Trump recently visited Iowa and Indiana to push his plan. He promoted how his steel tariffs have brought jobs to Northwest Indiana, but in other parts of the country, the steel tariffs have caused people to lose jobs. Now, Trump, to stem the backlash, he has offered a bailout to soybean farmers of $12 billion, but that move has been roundly criticized, including by soybean farmers themselves. Meanwhile, the Independent newspaper reports on the U.S. Senate unanimously voting to cut tariffs on hundreds of Chinese goods. These are tariffs that Trump had imposed. Now, China, of course, has retaliated against the Trump-imposed tariffs. Japan is looking to do more business with the EU and vice versa, as increasing numbers of countries consider Trump to be an unreliable partner. Meanwhile, the BRICS nations, which are Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, they met in South Africa last week to step up their coordination and cooperation on trade, banking, loans, and more. So let us just go now to, of all people, one of the captains of capitalism, Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan, on Trump's trade.
The way to look at trade, the president has raised serious issues that are pretty accurate around China that need to be fixed. We want NAFTA done. I think Mexico is wonderful neighbors. We want NAFTA done. And, you know, to be torturing Mexico this way, in my opinion, is dead wrong, and it should be fixed. We thought that what the president should do is work with Mexico, work with Canada, do TPP, work with our European allies and our Japanese allies, and go to China with a common front. That not against them, right. That this is the way the modern world should deal with trade, or particularly around IP, state-owned enterprises, and all these various issues. You know, now we have a kind of a little bit of a trade war, trade skirmish, however you want to define it, with all our allies and China. So if somehow if the president's team do a great job, you know, maybe we'll have a great outcome. But I would remind folks, the president's team has already said there will be no retaliation.
Right.
They've already been wrong. If you do another $200 billion of tariffs and this national security thing about cars, I think that you're getting pretty there close to having reversing some of the benefits that we've seen in the economy.
Trade advisors to the president in the White House tell me with great confidence that the economy is so strong, this is exactly the time for them to be addressing these issues with China and with Europe, and you know, and bringing back steel jobs. Do you buy that? That it's so
no,
strong.
I don't buy that, and I'd be a skeptic. I think there's an argument after the fact. I think you should do the right thing in trade, whether the economy is strong or not.
So we'd like to welcome economist Mark Weisbrot. Mark, thanks for joining us yet again. It's been a while, Mark. Mark, are you there? I'm not hearing Mark. Okay. While we're checking to make sure Mark is hearing and is on the line, Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He received his Ph.D. in economics from the University of Michigan. He's co-author of Social Security, The Phony Crisis. He's written several research papers. He's also a journalist with his column distributed in over 550 newspapers across the country, also in some international places. Oh, Mark, I think we have you now. Can you hear me?
Yes, thanks, Margaret. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay. So, Mark, your analysis of what the heck is going on here, I mean, I wonder if this is an instance where people on the left are agreeing with the captains of capitalism that Trump's moves are all bad all around. Your assessment of what's going on here?
Well, first, I think that, and I wrote this in The Nation in March when, this is 4 months ago, when Trump announced the first tariffs and everybody was panicking about trade wars. And I said that this whole threat of a trade war is overblown. And I think that's still true 4 months later. I don't see very much so far. I mean, there's $34 billion of tariffs on China, and that's, about 2% or 3% of China's exports. I don't think that's not much of a war. China has imposed retaliatory tariffs on soybeans primarily in the United States, and that's damaging. That's hurting some farmers here. But it's still, these are very, very small amounts we're talking about. I mean, the whole steel and aluminum tariffs that the U.S. imposed, I mean, the U.S. only imports $29 billion of steel a year, which is 0.14% of our GDP. That's very small. Aluminum's less than half of that. So far, there hasn't been anything that resembles an actual trade war. Now, Trump has made much bigger threats, but I don't think he'll carry them out for a whole number of reasons, which I can list.
Yeah. What about the impact, though, that it's having? Because it is, you know, there's a lot of talk about the nervousness of soybean farmers. People are actually looking at the falling prices in soybeans to make some predictions of what's going to happen in the midterm elections, because part of the context of all of this is the midterm elections. So Trump had to have had a reason to have offered this bailout to soybean farmers of $12 billion that the farmers themselves are calling welfare. And that they don't want welfare; they just want the tariffs to be lifted. And then there's a deal that Juncker from the EU recently met with Trump, and one result of that seems to be a backing down on all of that. I mean, Trump's threat on tariffs on European cars, for example, that seems to be going nowhere. So whether or not you call it a trade war, a skirmish, I mean, it does seem to be having a lot of impact, certainly a lot of conversation.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a political impact in the sense that, like I said, the soybean farmers were hurt by it, and he could pay a political price for that. But you're just not talking about anything that's going... Look, I mean, if you look at the effect of the trade agreements we've had or trade policy overall, you know, there's been huge effects. I mean, you know, since 2000, for example, we've lost 4.5 million manufacturing jobs. That's due to trade, not trade wars. And you look at all the negative effects of these trade agreements, the increased price of pharmaceuticals, you know, that's cost the pharmaceutical monopolies are costing us hundreds of billions of dollars a year that we pay. And that's actually what Trump is negotiating the hardest for in these trade skirmishes. He's fighting with China over intellectual property. He's threatening to impose really bigger tariffs on China if they don't respect U.S. Patents and copyright. So this is not, he's not trying to save jobs here. And so, in other words, we've lost enormously. If you look at the people of this country, the vast majority have lost in terms of job employment and wages. We've lost as a result of the and not only wages and employment, but also the access to life-saving pharmaceuticals. We've lost because of that, because of the agreements we've signed, because of NAFTA, because of the WTO, and other trade agreements. So this kind of thing, which is the media, which is in favor of these agreements generally, and of course has a bias towards what people like Jamie Dimon think. You notice he mentioned intellectual property right away.
Yeah,
as one of the goals of this. This is not trade. This is monopolies. This is trying to reinforce monopolies that corporations have. So that's why this whole thing becomes such a panicked discourse. But really, I don't see it happening. As you just mentioned, he did settle with Europe, okay? And so I think that conflict is practically over. And why is that? That's another thing I think other people won't mention, except on a show like this. You know, every day there's another article about the Anglo-American world order collapsing, the great liberal American world order of the post-World War II period, and this fight with Europe, and how dangerous this is for the entire world, because this is what enforces the liberal world order. And there's a dark side to this, and I think this is why you won't see a real trade war with Europe. It's one of the reasons. And this is because this transatlantic alliance is not just this friendly relationship between countries who believe in democracy as it's portrayed. It's an alliance of the rich countries, and not the rich countries so much as they're the elite of the rich countries.
Yeah.
But these are the richest countries in the world. And it's an alliance of them against the rest of the world. They control the IMF. They wrote the rules of the WTO.
Yeah.
They're the main voice in the G20. All the institutions of global governance that matter are controlled by a handful of countries led by the United States. And so they're not going to fight. I mean, they'll fight a little bit, Trump, you know, because he's just posturing.
Yeah.
So he'll have these fights.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, what does it mean? Well, Mark, we're going to have to carry on this discussion because we're out of time right now, and we didn't get a chance to talk about China because we know that there is concern by Trump and others about the rise of China and what that might mean, and with the BRICS nations trying to get themselves together. So we'll have to carry on that conversation, but we appreciate you coming and breaking this down for us. Mark Weisbrot. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you,
Margaret. All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And now I'd like to welcome our next guest, Derimar Gonzalez, who is an Afro-Cuban pianist and composer. He has a new album out, The Grand Concourse, and he has been on tour, and he's continuing his tour to several cities across the U.S. Derimar, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, and we do want people, our listeners, to hear some of your music. So let's go to a short clip now of about you, including some of your music.
I'm Derimar Gonzalez, a Cuban pianist and composer based in New York. I'm not just a jazz composer, I compose contemporary music, I compose the music of today. Piano for me was always part of my life. I remember that my dad used to play with Conjunto Rumbabana and Mirta Medina, La Isla Sonora, and many of these bands used to rehearse it in my living room. And I always wanted to be part of that amazing world as a pianist too. The first jazz artist that I started listening, it was Chucho Valdés. I have been close to him for many years. He's one of my mentors, my dad first, and then him. Chucho Valdés with Iraguere impressed me a lot. The way he was writing for those brass sessions, the way Chucho Valdés sat down on the piano and had that amazing sound, really cultivated me a lot since the first time that I heard him.
Wow, that is just amazing. First of all, hearing your music, dear Mer, but also your influences, starting with your dad. You mentioned Chucho Valdés, well-known, of course. Who are some of your other influences?
I would say that Keith Jarrett, the piano player, and Chick Corea, they were two of my main heroes when I was growing up. They have such a great sound in the piano, discovering the classical sound of the piano with some great, great contemporary jazz chords that have been, you know, really some of my heroes in the piano, for my piano influences. Yes, wow.
Right. And our listeners in Southern California on July 28th heard you. I heard there were at least 1,000 people, if not more, turning out. So you have been in Philadelphia and Portland, Seattle, Los Angeles, including in San Pedro, California. But you're continuing, right? So our listeners in some other places like New York and Connecticut, California, Northern California will have a chance to hear you. Darimer, tell us about that, about your tour.
Yes, we are performing on Wednesday in a place that is called the Write-Off Room, and then we go on August 4th to San Francisco to be part of the San Francisco Jazz Festival, and then we go to the East Coast to, you know, to be part of the Harlem Havana Jazz Festival, and so on, so on, so on, so on. I'm very happy. I'm also going to do now in the beginning of October my debut performance at Lincoln Center in New York. So this is something that I have been like super, super looking forward and excited about it too.
Yeah, right. Now, I wondered if you could just quickly share with us a work that you've been involved with, which is Senciles. I think I've said that the right word, which is the Cuban musical history. And also tributes to some musicians that some in our audience may be familiar with. Who are some of those musicians? And tell us about Senciles.
Yes, Senciles is a song that I created to pay tribute to some of the greatest Cuban classical composers that influenced me since a very, very early age, like, you know, Lecuona, Ernesto Lecuona, Manuel Saumel, Ignacio Cervantes, José María Vitier. Those great pianists, they had such a strong classical background, and what they did is that they took the classical music into the popular music of Cuba. So they create a sound that is called La Contradanza, La Danza, and they develop a such a unique sound into the piano that was amazing. So what I took, I learned those foundations into my own piano compositions, and then just orchestrated with a string quartet, the flute into the album, just to, you know, because I was listening to some chorus inside the song, and I just wanted to, you know, to present it to the audience, not from the piano perspective, but also, you know, from the orchestra and chamber music perspective instead.
Right, and included, you have a tribute to Buena Vista Social Club, one of my favorites, uh-huh. But also Mozart, another favorite of mine, and John Coltrane, another favorite, right, mixed with you. But then quickly take us then to Grand Concourse. Tell us about that,
yeah.
Your latest.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. The Grand Concourse in general, the whole album, is basically my way to, you know, to show with the world, you know, the platform Or who I am as an artist in general. You know, I didn't want it to portray it instead just like a Cuban pianist himself. Just I wanted to really like discover a very broad palette of sound of Cuba. You know, because I'm a young individual that born and raised in Havana, now being tape in at Berklee College of Music, and then now living in New York, touring the world, and somehow absorbing all of those influences and putting into my music. So this album is basically the grand concourse. It's the concourse where I decide where people to meet me musical wise.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm sure our listeners are going to be running online to find your music, to look for Grand Concourse, I think, that just came out, and also the cities where you will be touring: August 4th in San Francisco, August 19th in Harlem, New York, September 15th in Ridgefield, Connecticut, October 11th in New York, and October 13th also in Jamaica, Queens in New York. So, dear Mayor Gonzalez, we appreciate your music. We want to congratulate you on your tour and your huge success in Southern California. And thank you so very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Big hug to all of you guys. And thank you. Thank you. I'm so pleased. Thank you.
Okay. We also want to thank Suzanne Thompson for her help with this segment. We're out of time. I'd like to thank all of today's guests. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the show tomorrow. I'd also like to thank our team today, our board op, Gary Baca, our assistant producer, Romero Funes, today's show producer. Produced by myself, Margaret Prescott. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland, and here's the lineup for the rest of the morning. Press Watch in just a couple of minutes. Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Per Fogering welcomes journalist Joe Loria from ConsortiumNews.com, who says that the U.S. media is clinging to hopes of Russian collusion. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, Lisa Loving welcomes back Gregory Pardlow to talk about his new book, Air Traffic. At 11:30, Black Book Talk welcomes librarian Patricia Hurd Hobson to discuss the best books they've ever read. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm, click on donate. It's 9:01. Press Watch is next.
I'm 50 years old.
KBOO Community Radio is 50. We are celebrating our birthday with a big street fair and party on August 11th from noon to 10 p.m. here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. We'll be broadcasting live bands all day and an open house celebrating 50 years of KBOO. There will be a reunion from 2 to 5 during the street party for folks looking to see KBOO volunteers.